Have you ever wanted something and you thought, you know what, let's just take it? Well, today we're going to go over Vincenzo Prega and his theft of the Mona Lisa.
Ladies and gentlemen of all ages, boys and girls, thank you for tuning in to yet another episode of Angry Me Production. We appreciate you coming in and letting us be a part of your lives, week in and week out. We hope to do our best to present you with something that your eardrums delight in. Whether you're looking at us on YouTube or Rumble, or listening to us on Spotify, Google, or Anchor, or any of the other podcast services that we are currently on or trying to get on, we thank you. And if you don't mind, at the end of every episode, stop by, leave us a comment, leave us a like. If it asks for 5 stars, we'll take 5 stars, even if you don't like us. 5 stars are what it's all about. With that being said, we hope you enjoy our attempt to make our advocation, our vocation. Ladies and gentlemen, let the games begin.
We here at Angry Me Production want to thank our sponsor, Mobile Notary Mindy. She's certified with the National Notary Association. She's also bonded and E&O insured. She offers a wide range of services, including wills, powers of attorney, medical documents, healthcare proxies, living wills, certification of trust, assignment of personal property, HIPAA waivers, advanced healthcare directives, and 99 verification. You can find her on Facebook, TikTok, and Instagram at Mobile Notary Mindy. You can also visit her webpage at TexasMobileNotaryMindy.com. That's TXMobileNotaryMindy.com. Thank you so much and enjoy the show.
Welcome, Angry Faithful. Yes, this week we're going to take a little bit of a trip on something that's not murder and all kinds of the depravity of humanity, but we're gonna go over the theft of the Mona Lisa. I've always loved this this little case in history because it's just if you get into the in depths of it and how. And it's one cases that it was publicized nationwide. It was the whole thing. It just ends up being an amazing story of you know one man's you know theft, and it just populates the Louvre and made the Louvre popular. Because at the point, the Louvre wasn't even that popular. Now, just to get a little bit of hindsight of the Louvre back then and how the Mona Lisa was stolen by this man. The Louvre at that time, before the theft, actually wasn't very well known. A lot of the works of art was, I mean, it was stolen. Not just the Mona Lisa. Most of the artwork in the Louvre have been procured. We'll say that procured through various conquests by Napoleon and various means, I guess you would say. But and it's like most national history museums. Sometimes the stuff is given to the museum, and sometimes you conquer a country, you get stuff, and you like it, so you show it off. It happens. Now. Saying that, during this time frame, a lot of what a lot of people don't understand, and we'll get in more, hopefully, a little bit more depth into it. A lot of the security guards were ex-military; they were getting a pension, and most of them, throughout the story, fell asleep on the job or they were doing the job, and at the time before the theft, they had very little visitors. It was just one of those things that people maybe went to. It wasn't really popular or people went out of the ways to go to the Louvre. Saying that this man literally, and there's some other speculations I would get into it after we are done. And I got my new cup. British Tears existed since 1776. Love those British Tears. And yes, it is sweet tea. It's not regular tea. It's not British tea. Screw British tea. Get some Southern sweet tea with enough sugar that it could probably give you diabetes after you drink it. A normal person would probably just sip the tea and get diabetes, just like your grandma used to make. Not measuring, just dumping. All right. Now, with this person, there isn't that much information during that time frame. A lot of the information is just, you know, various people that went over the case, got a little bit of history, as much of history as they could possibly get on somebody that not a lot of people. He became infamous after the theft, but eventually down the road, he ended up changing his name after World War One. It's a sad case, but he's still like a little bit appraised in France. I guess it's one of those things. It's like, this SOB got one over on us. We still like him though. You know that type of person where they shit on you, but you don't mind it sometimes. All right. Now, Vicino Prega was born October 8th, 1881, in Dunsinane, a small village in the Alps of Italy in the border of Switzerland. Now, for a brief period when he moved to Paris, he did work at the Louvre. He was cleaning and reframing paintings. Some have stated that the job required him to construct strong cases for some of the artwork in the museum, including one for the Mona Lisa by Leonardo da Vinci. Yeah, sometimes I'm going to, if I actually know how to pronounce it and everything, I'm going to probably do it in the country of Rome. Leonardo da Vinci. You have to say it like that. You cannot not say that. You need Leonardo DiCaprio. Yeah. But if you talk about Leonardo da Vinci, you'd have to talk about, and you have to do the hand signals and everything. Leonardo da Vinci. See, you have to do it. You cannot not do it. It's so hard. I can't help it. Love you all in Italy. Anyways, the theft happened in 1911. Prega prepared a. I see I had to do a Prega too. A Prega. Prega. All right. Sorry, being silly. Prepared what has been described as the greatest art thief in the 20th century. According to Prega's later interrogation in Florence, Italy, following his arrest on December 12th, 1913, the former museum workman claimed he entered the Musée du Louvre. Which is a full name. I'm not getting away from that Italian accent. Hold on, everybody. Let me compose myself in such a manner. Yeah, fuck it. On Monday, August 21st, 1911, around 7 a.m., through the door where the other Louvre workers were entering, wearing one of the white worksman's smocks that museum's employees customary wore, making himself indistinguishable from the other workers. When this Salon Carré, where the Mona Lisa hung, was empty, he left the painting off its four iron pegs. And yes, they describe everything on the, even in the documentary, it was the four iron pegs. Iron pegs. Man, I can't even pronounce that one. Iron. Okay, there we go. That secured it to the wall between Carrio's Majestic Marriage and Titania's Ergo of Francis de Velza, and took it to a nearby stairway of the Supper Marais. There he removed the protective case and frame, hiding the discarded elements behind some students' artwork stored on the staircase landing. Now, some people reported that he concealed the painting, which Leonardo da Vinci painted on wood, under his smock that was larger than him. But Prego was only 160 centimeters or 63 inches. God, they're not doing the whole thing. Hold on real quick. Let me do this in feet. Because he was
63 in.
Wrong word. Wrong one. There we go. In feet. He was 5'2". Wow, he was short. Short. Wow. Yeah, high in that painting is. But the Mona Lisa measured approximately 21 inches by 30 inches, so it would not fit under his smock worn by someone his size. Instead, he told investigators he took his smock and wrapped it around the painting before tucking it underneath his arm and left the The Louvre. I have to do it that way or I'm not going to be able to pronounce it. Through the same door he entered, Prega hid the painting in his apartment in Paris, having investigated all the Louvre permanent staff. Jean Marais began to investigate extraneous workers, including bricklayers, decorators, and staff hired for short periods of time for a specific job in September 1911. During this period, officers visited Prega's apartment, questioning him twice about the possible involvement. However, he was not considered a prime suspect. And I watched a documentary on this. The lead investigator, with his hubris, believed that the person was either a rich person that valued the art and just wanted, I mean, they blamed America on this one. So, surprise, surprise. But they blamed like a rich American that wanted to have it in his basement with a cigar. I mean, it was specific. Have it with his cigar, smoking a cigar, looking at the painting with a glass of whiskey. Which, mind you, that could have been a possibility. But they knew it had to be in their mind, through their theories, that it was a person of stature, a middle class or above. It wasn't, Prego was very poor. He had an apartment. But after keeping the painting hidden in a trunk in his apartment for 2 years, Prego returned to Italy with it. He kept it in his apartment in Florence, Italy, for some time. However, Prego eventually grew impatient and was finally caught when he contacted we're just going to have Stephanie Hawkins do this one.
Mario Fratelli.
Mario Fratelli, the owner of the art gallery in Florence. Fratelli's story conflicted with Prega's, but it was clear that Prega's expected a reward for returning the painting returning the painting to what he regarded as its homeland. Fratelli called Giovanni Prega, Giovanni Poggi, director of the Josefaus Gallery, who authenticated the painting. Fratelli, after taking the painting for safekeeping, informed the police and arrested Prega at his hotel. After his recovery, the painting was exhibited all over Italy with a banner headlines, "Rejoice, it's return." The Mona Lisa was then returned to the Louvre in 1913, while the painting was famous for before the theft. Not really. The notoriety It received newspapers and headlines with large scale police investigation helped the artwork become one of the best known in the world, gaining considerable public interest. The motivation of this theft, there was two prominent theories regarding the theft of the Mona Lisa. Prega said it did not, he did it for a patriotic reason. He wanted to bring the painting back and display it in Italy after it was stolen from Napoleon. When Prega worked at the Louvre, he learned how Napoleon plundered many Italian works of art during the Napoleonic Wars. Perhaps securely in his motivation, Prega may not have known that the Leonardo da Vinci took this painting and gave it to Francis the First when he moved to France to become a painter in the court during the 16th century, 250 years before the Napoleon's birth. Experts have questioned the patriotic motives on the grounds that if patrium was a true motivation, Prega would have donated the painting to an Italian museum rather than attempt to profit from it from its sale. Questions of the money is also confirmed by letters that Prega sent to his father after the theft on 22nd December 1911, four months after the theft. He wrote that Paris was where I will make my fortune, that his fortune will arrive in one shot. The following year, he wrote, I am making a vow for you to live long and enjoy the prize that your son is about to realize for you and for our family. But when he was on trial, the court argued to some extent that Prega committed his crimes for patriotic reasons and gave him a lenient sentence. And he was sent to jail for only 1 year and 15 days, but was held as a great patriot in Italy and served only 7 months. Another theory later emerged, claiming that the theft may have been encouraged or masterminded by Edward Howe. Words are twisting in my mouth today. Hold on real quick. I knew this was going to happen beforehand, so I apologize. And yes, it is going to happen all the time.
Eduardo de Valfierno.
A con man who commissioned a French art forgerer, Yves Caron. Now, this is another theory that I've always loved because it's actually, now it's known as the Mona Lisa con. And we're going to get more into this theory that has emerged. But the way the con goes is you steal a work of art. And you wait a while. Then you reprint this work I have. The whole time frame, you're not redoing the work of art, but you're copying the work of art. And you start selling those copies while you have the original. So rich people think, oh, I have the original. Look at it. It is so glamorous and great. I got this off the black market, but from what I understand, there was 3 copies, presumably made. By the way, there is a lot of copies of the Mona Lisa, and it was determined that the one that's in the Louvre is the real Mona Lisa. Now, there's going to be people out there that read up on that little con and go, no, it's not the real Mona Lisa. They did such a good job. They backdated it with scrapes of the paint they got from the painting, and it dates back 250 years, 16th century. So it is the original painting. Now, the con man who had commissioned the French art forger Yves Caron to make copies of the painting so he could sell it and the original. The copies would have gone up in value if its originals were stolen. The theory is based entirely in a 1932 article by former Hearst journalist Kirk Dechler. In the Saturday Evening Post, Dechler claimed that to have known Verferno and other stories from him in 1913, promising not to print it until he learned Verferno's death. There is no external confirmation for this theory. Now, later enough, Prego was released from jail after a short time serving in the Italy Army, and he also served in the Army, Italian Army, in World War One. During the war, he was captured by Austrian-Hungary soldiers, held in a POW camp for 2 years until the war ended, and he was released. He would later remarry and have a daughter, Christina, and returned to France to his work as a painter decorator using his birth name, Pietro Prega. He died on October 8th, 1925, at the age of 44, in the Paris suburbs of Saint Maura del Fortes, France. He was buried in the Cornet Cemetery of Saint Maura del Fortes sometime in the 1950s. Prego's remains were exhumed and relocated in Simley Bone Locker. And I was looking at that. I'm trying to figure out why it was that way. Let's see here. Call cemeterium instructor, usually public story. Urns holding cemetery remains of the dead. I don't know. I guess it's, I have no idea. I guess I did it just because, you know, they needed to. It was nothing fancy and nothing against him and whatnot. So I thought it was, you know, something special, but it wasn't. It's just they needed to bring the cemetery. The bodies in there a little bit closer. Anyways, his death in 1925 was not widely reported in the media at the time, possibly because he died under the name Pietro Prega. And the obituaries appeared mistakenly only when another Vincenzo Prega died in 1947. Now, to get a little bit more in depth in the theft, most of this stuff was actually through a documentary. And the person on the case, let me get his name. I listened to it several times. The detective Louis Lepine. Now, at this time frame, Lepine was considered the world's greatest detective. And he basically, they called him it. They felt that he was the best suited for the job. And he went over like deductive reasoning at the time. The fingerprints were just the newest rage in forensics. And they went in. And they found a single fingerprint, smudge fingerprint, on the glass that was housing on the glass. And the reason why they had the glass there, go figure, there was a, someone had already slashed a painting, which destroying works of art is, everybody's like, oh, it's the newest craze. No, they've been doing it for a long time. Anyways, mind you. Found a single fingerprint, and at the time you'd have to go in. They had these fingerprint cards. They would have the photo of the person, and they would have their fingerprints, and they had like 700,000 of them that they had to go through of known suspects. Now, saying that, the detective decided, hey, maybe it's an inside job. So he went over, he printed all the people inside the that worked there at the time. And then after he figured out that it wasn't them, he went in and looked at other people that had worked and was either A, laid off, or the contract had ended. Now, like I said, they went over Prega. They didn't even think Prega was the person in the entrance. Like I said, he was poor. He wouldn't have valued the painting. And it was the hubris of the detective that did that. Like I already said, they interviewed him twice. And the first time they searched the place casually, both times, and then said that he wasn't a suspect. And that's why how he got away with it for like 2 years. Mind you, nowadays we still don't have like a big we have more assets at our disposal, but sometimes the best way to get information and everything is from the people that's been there and through the investigations. Yeah. That concludes our episode for today on Psychos and Sociopaths. Like I said, I wanted to take a little bit of breath on the mayhem and depravity of the other things I usually do on here, like massacres and serial killers and gangs murders and everything. I just wanted to do something light today. Have a nice shiny day. And just have something fun that was interesting in my book. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for watching. And goodbye.